Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. We have an empowering hour. Always the latest on health and healing. Then I'm going to share some audio clips and ask you to call in and give us your opinion. I believe that in any ethical and decent moral society, we should respect all life. We should respect the rights of every woman, man, child, and we should not engage in identity politics. I believe it's tearing us apart, and it's been used for political reasons, cleverly disguised by those in power, both right and left. And what does it gain, we the people? Nothing. Having taught on college campuses my entire adult life, I'm very concerned by the environment that I find there. It doesn't mean you can't get a good education. It doesn't mean there are not some outstanding instructors and professors. There are. At state schools, public universities, and private schools. But what has been very insidious has been the inclusion that somehow today's students are victims. They're victims of an evil culture. And it's gone to such extremes that if you're not made aware of it, you wouldn't believe it's even there. It is. And then that seeps out into the larger economy. People then, when they leave university, they take those attitudes and beliefs into their work environment. It's toxic. So today we're going to have two different people, a Professor Jonathan Hitt, H-I-D-T. It's a short clip, but it's really good about the rise of victimhood culture on campus. And then I've heard this so often, that men and women are the same, that our brains are the same, and therefore we should not have any real distinction between the two. It's simply not true. When we were doing our research for the documentary that was on PBS stations called Mind Power, we had a chance to film some of the leading neuroscientists. And there are numerous differences, not just gender, but genetic differences that impact a person's attitude, feelings, and the level of empathetic response. But there's a whole movement to say, nope, they're the same, and therefore everything has to be equal, 50-50. And in that context, it may seem politically fine. But what if a proclivity, what if something that is inherent, what if something that is instinctual and intuitive says, if we're all given the same absolute opportunity, why is it some go in one direction, others in another? So we're going to have on a segment by a person that you may not have heard of. She is a very bright human being, controversial, and a lot of people on the left do not like her, don't want to have anything to do with her. Well, that's a mistake. She's Professor Famengo, F-I-A-M-E-N-G-O, and she is a professor of English at the University of Ottawa, and she hosts a show on YouTube. And she challenges a lot of the academic feminism by examining its tenets and bizarre obsessions and outlandish claims, and more importantly, its impact upon the students in Western culture. Again, you can agree or disagree in part or whole, but to deny her forms is foolish. I believe in freedom of speech. I don't believe in selective freedom of speech. If I disagree with someone, the best way to challenge it is not to censor them or attack them, but rather to hear them out and then deconstruct their arguments. So that's what we're going to be doing. I think you'll find it of interest. We always start with the latest on healing, and one of the healing nutrients that I believe we would benefit from as a society, if we included it, would be spirulina. Spira, S-P-I-R-U, lina, L-I-N-A. It is a algae. It's a single-celled algae, and the critics of this kind of food call it pond scum. Well, I wish that they had pond scum that could be as beneficial to the body as this is. It grows on the surface. It's a blue-green algae, and it's been around since life itself. And named for the microscopic spiraling helixes it forms, its green color is derived from chlorophyll. So the underlying issue is, how much chlorophyll does it contain, and why is chlorophyll missing from most people's diets, and why is it so important? Well, the blue color originates from a pigment called phycocyanin. That's P-H-Y-C-O-C-Y-A-N-I-N. And that does an awful lot of good in the body. The production of bone marrow stem cells, anti-cancer natural killer cells. It inhibits cancer colony formation. And it's low on the food chain and converts sunlight to protein and fatty acids and carbohydrates and a multitude of different essential nutrients. I was using it back in the laboratory because I was comparing it to the egg in a project called the Egg Project. And that project was based upon a hunch, pure hypothesis. When traveling in South America, including in the Amazon jungles in Brazil, I wondered how was it that this man I saw, who was 70, was climbing a coconut tree as if he were 18 years old. He had no body fat. He was ripped in muscles. He didn't lift weights. And when you started looking at their diet, you saw that it was very close to nature, very little processing. They had a lot of gourds and a tremendous amount of fruits, but also they would include leaves and herbs I was not familiar with. But also they would eat anything that came from the sea. Well, blue-green algae is one of those. It's very abundant. Anyhow, I came back, and I'm thinking, they're eating beans, and beans I'd never seen before, and rice, but very little meat, generally on occasion, but not often. So how is it that they're living longer? Is there something in their diets that we're not aware of? So I did what was called the Egg Project, because in America, the egg is considered the highest quality protein. It has the highest net protein utilization, meaning it will provide more amino acids to the body than any other source of food at the highest percentage. And when I started to combine different plant-based foods, I came up with some formulas that were actually higher than the egg. And I had a Dr. Hillard Fitzke reconfirm this with his computers that he had over at the University Hospital where he was working. And about 6 months later, he came back with 5,000 combinations of a vegan diet that had more protein utilization at a higher rate of net protein utilization, meaning the amount that the body actually uses, than any other meat, fish, chicken, pork, dairy. So in effect, it established an entirely new paradigm. Now in lay language, what it means is that you never in your life need anything from an animal. No dairy, no meat. You can get all your protein and calcium and other nutrients from plants. But the highest amount of protein came from spirulina. And when I added spirulina to anything, it shot up the protein, net protein value beyond the egg. So in effect, we established a new dietetic and nutritional reality. The egg can no longer be considered the highest net protein utilization. We had three different foods that were higher. It took about a year and a half to do this study because I had to do an amino acid analysis of every single fruit, vegetable, herb, seed, plant, nut, grain. And I then submitted this to MIT, to Harvard, to the USDA, to the American Dietetic Association, all these prestigious organizations. I didn't get a response from a single one. And I couldn't figure that out. Why is it that if you show that you can give a protein, which are the amino acids and proteins are the building blocks that for our muscles and other tissue, why wouldn't they be interested in this? First, because the meat industry is a $200+ billion a year industry. Virtually every single study in the scientific literature shows that a plant-based diet is healthier and a meat-based diet is dangerous. You can show all forms of estrogen imbalance that leading to higher breast cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, etc. So everything negative is on the side of animal proteins. Everything positive is on the side of plant. And then I decided, what the heck? I went ahead and held a press conference. It was all day. It was at a high school, RFK Hospital, over on the east side. It was packed. And that's when I laid out this whole new principle that you do not have to consume any animal proteins to get all of your protein. And yet I'd grown up where my mother believed, as most other mothers believed, you have to feed your family protein 3 times a day because that's what they were told. In the morning, that's your bacon and eggs or sausage and eggs and milk. In the afternoon, you know, your grilled cheese sandwich, you know, Heinz tomato soup, and a glass of milk. In the evening, either fish or roast beef or pork or something. But it was all a lie. It was a manufactured lie. And we were told, well, it'll make you weak. It was not true. The strongest animals in the world are vegan, like an elephant, and most gorillas, and long-lived. Longest-lived creature in the world is Galapagos turtle. They can live hundreds of years, though a shark is supposed to have lived almost 700 years. Whether that's true or not, it's probably the longest-lived creature on Earth. But the turtle has got a slow metabolism and is non-stressed, and it eats plants. So we just seem to refuse the truth. It took me 12 years to finally have that accepted for publication in a peer-reviewed journal. And it's up on the website. You can read it, the actual publication. Well, for a lot of people that day, we estimated there were over 1,600 people throughout the day came. And I had a panel of scientists who were there and physicians who were talking about what it means when you put a plant-based diet instead of a meat-based diet. People will lose weight, they'll get stronger, healthier, complexions clear up, pain, digestion improves, all these conditions. And I was talking about the best sources of protein, the highest sources of protein, and spirulina was the tops, number one. Chlorella was right behind it, and of course they're both high in chlorophyll. Now, by any measure, spirulina is one of the best superfoods that we have. The Mayans used it. The Aztecs used it for thousands of years. And it contains 65 to 71% of all vegetable or vegetarian proteins. That's the highest concentration found in any food. It's a complete protein, meaning that it contains all of the essential amino acids as well as 10 other amino acids. So it's good for your muscles, for your bone, for strength, endurance. And it's eaten raw and it never loses any of its protein content. And just letting you know, something that simple and inexpensive and is out there and no one pays attention to it. I do remember looking at all the science at that time, and it has antiviral properties. So anyone with any viral, like herpes, hepatitis, cytomegalovirus, Epstein-Barr virus, it's really good. It fights inflammation and helps you if you have arthritis. It has a perfect lipid profile, which means that it stimulates immune response. It's very good for helping with relieving colitis. It has zeaxanthin, an antioxidant that I mentioned yesterday that helps reduce the risk of cataracts and age-related macular degeneration. It protects bone marrow cells from radiation. It promotes stem cell genesis and protects against declines in neural stem cell proliferation. So, a woman contacted me, and she came by the institute. And she came by one evening, and she said that she would like a copy of all the research because she was the head of a division within the UN that dealt with agricultural support of countries in Africa. And her argument was, if I could show that these plant-based nutrients could grow in a more arid environment, then that would reduce the need of these countries of seeking aid, which were generally non-fat dry milk or cheeses, which many of them were glucose intolerant and couldn't, not glucose, but were dairy intolerant, casein intolerant, whey intolerant, and yet we were sending them massive amounts of non-fat dry milk. And she said that's a danger because first, the hydrate that they're using frequently polluted water, and then the mothers were giving this to their babies, and the babies were getting sick, diarrhea, and dying. So I showed her that you could grow in any area of Africa, no matter how arid, and there are certain plants that are known to thrive in more dry climates, and then you could take that grain, for example, like millet, and you could crush it and make it into a powder and add in some oils like coconut oil and or cassava oil, and you could then feed that to people as a porridge, and it would give them much higher nutrient value. You know, it would save a lot of people. It would save countless people from malnutrition and save children as well. So 3 months later, I didn't hear from her. And then one day she called and she said it was a great idea, but like a lot of things at the UN, someone then starts to realize that if we started giving all this information and even product, because I also said it would be very easy to give, to take this, let's say, three primary nutrients, that's all, a grain, a nut, and a bean, or you could use a legume. And you could simply pulverize it into a powder and blend it. And then you could add some other nutrients like B12 and the omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin C, B-complex. And then they would have, you could take these in 55-gallon drums and you could give a village of that was really in need of food. You could give them, you know, however many people live there, you could give them that many drums. And each drum could give a person all the nutrients they needed, so they wouldn't suffer from malnutrition and die. And these are not expensive. And she had that information also. I even gave her the names and address contacts of three different manufacturers that would do this at cost because of the important humanitarian work that was involved in. And she did her homework and all this was good. And then she called me and says, the trouble is, they're companies that are making a profit, a very large profit, by selling these other foods in Africa. So they turned thumbs down on it. It's just something that just popped in my mind, how making a profit was more important than saving millions of lives in Africa. Anyhow, that just came into my mind about that research and the fact that we don't have to have any animal protein. We would thrive on a plant-based protein, save money, save the environment, save global warming. That's how important it is. Also, beetroot. Now, that's the actual bulb of the beet. Beyond the bulb are the stems and the flowering of the plant and the green, all of which are good. You can juice all that. Well, there's a new study that shows that from the Heart and Diabetes Institute in Melbourne that shows that it can lower blood pressure. So adding simply a glass of beet juice to your daily diet can help reduce blood pressure, and especially in men. That research was done in Australia. So the beet juice is inexpensive. And what it does is that it contains nitrate and nitric oxide. And that helps relax your blood vessels. And that allows a lowering of your systolic blood pressure in the magnitude of 5 mmHg, and that reduces death rates by at least 10%. And this was published in the Journal of Nutritional Journal. So something inexpensive, something easy to do, and athletes also should be consuming that because it helps them. There was a large study done on green tea, and it showed it had the ability to protect you against cancer of the digestive system. And this was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, and they examined in the Shanghai Women's Health Study 70,000 non-smoking middle-aged and older women who regularly drank green tea. And they drank green tea 3 days a week, and that lowered the amount of disease and cancer by 14%. That is very important. In men, green tea produces a similar benefit to your prostate gland and reduces your PSA, which is a protein associated with cancer. It reduces inflammation of your prostate. So it's easy to use. It also reduced the lymph cancers by 48%. That's terrific. And finally, a study showed that daily consumption of soda, you know, soft drink, increases your stroke risk by 83%. Let me repeat that. Because we are a nation, as is Great Britain, that drinks a lot of soft drinks. So, you increase your risk of heart disease, asthma, and COPD when you're consuming soft drinks by 83%, an increased risk of stroke. That was a study done in Japan and found that women specifically who drink every day have an increased risk of 83%, but it's also high for men as well. So give up the soft drinks and help protect yourself against a stroke. Also, I'm a big believer in echinacea. Echinacea is great to help you prevent catching a cold or the flu. And all you have to do is look at the actual science, and it's there. All these thousands of studies show that echinacea helps with acid indigestion, ADHD, chronic fatigue syndrome, diphtheria, dizziness, genital warts or herpes, and gum disease, which a lot of people have. You're talking about big-time numbers when it comes to gums disease, and most people are not even aware of it. But it also reduces malaria, migraine headaches, pain, rheumatism, septicemia, which is a bloodstream infection, streptococcus infections, syphilis, the flu, urinary tract infections, and vaginal yeast infections. So just stuff that helps us every day, and there's no reason not to take it. We're 24 minutes into our program. I'm Gary Nall on location, the last 2 days of a retreat helping our sister station. And because I've been on the go from 4 in the morning until midnight and doing multiple lectures a day and helping out on the road and in the gym, and I haven't had opportunity to help our sister station raise money live, at least during this past 2 weeks. But beginning next week, I will help them with some live premiums. We have some brand new premiums, and they're struggling right now. In fact, this is the lowest amount of money in the station's history that they've ever received. It's grossing about $5,000, but that's at 100% fulfillment rate, meaning people call in and then send in their money. It's more realistic, about 70%. So it's really about $3,000 a day. That doesn't begin to cover all the expenses. So this retreat has helped pay for an awful lot of premiums, not just from my program, but from other producers as well. So we'll be back to helping the station next week. And my hope is that we'll bring those numbers up so they can pay some bills. We'll be back in a moment. And we're going to go directly into an audio clip. And the audio clip that you're going to hear is The Rise of Victimhood Culture on Campus. And where people now see you as either good or evil, boy, is there a danger to this. And after we hear it, you'll have an opportunity to call in and share your comments and points of view. That number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. Back in a moment.
Well, obviously, I mean, it's right there on the crest, Veritas. That's right. That's what's sacred at a university, right? That's the most important thing for us, right? We circle around that. But my argument is that what has been happening since the 1990s is there's been a change. The most sacred thing at a university is the victim. Not in all departments, not in the sciences, but in the social sciences, especially the humanities, the victim is the most sacred thing. Now, you can see this especially here. There are six groups of victims, traditionally, since the 90s. So most, whenever there are big political blow-ups and controversies, they tend to be around race issues, gender issues, or LGBT issues. Those are the big three. There are three other groups that are sacred, too, but there just seems to be less controversy around Latinos, Native Americans, and disability status. They all matter, but these are, I believe, the six sacred groups since I joined the Academy in the 90s. Now, the last 2 years have been so extraordinary. Again, studying moral psychology, it's like I go back and forth between saying, oh my God, the world is going to hell and I'm scared out of my mind, to saying, oh my God, this is so unbelievably interesting. I can't believe that moral psychology helps us understand everything. So the last 2 years have been extraordinary because there's been a revolution just in 2 years. We've added a seventh group. So now Muslims, it depends on the school, but at some schools, Muslims are now in the sacred category. So any criticism of Islam or of Muslims is equivalent to, can't be done. Transgender issues have rocketed from obscurity a couple of years ago to the front line of campus politics now. And of course, Black Lives Matter, since we all saw those horrible videos beginning in 2014 of unarmed black men being killed. So there's a huge amount of moral passion, and it comes onto campus, and it is transforming the life of the university. The clearest expression of this, what this has given us, this polarizing, has given us what some sociologists call victimhood culture. This is the key to understanding the new moral culture on campus just in the last few years. So these two sociologists, Bradley Campbell and Jason Manning, they wrote this wonderful essay 2 years ago. They were trying to understand, they started hearing about microaggressions, and they were wondering, why do some campuses talk about microaggressions? And why only some campuses? And this is 2 years ago, before most of us had ever heard the term. And their analysis is that there's a long-term change. Cultures change, their moral culture changes. And many cultures, including American culture, long ago had elements of an honor culture. In an honor culture, people will often shun reliance on law or any other authority, even when available. They refuse to lower their standing by depending on another to handle their affairs. So in an honor culture, a gentleman cannot tolerate any stain upon his honor. And if you insult me in any public forum, even in a small way, I have to challenge you and get you to back down, or I lose honor. And that's why you get dueling. So all the way up until the end of the 18th century in America, we have dueling. Now, gradually, as our commercial system changes, as we get more big, more diverse, challenging people to duels begins to look kind of stupid in the 19th century, and it fades out. And it's replaced, they say, by what they call a dignity culture. In a dignity culture, dignity exists independently of what others think, so a culture of dignity is one in which public reputation is less important. It's even commendable to have thick skin. Parents might even teach children some version of sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never harm me, something I heard a lot growing up. Now, obviously, words do hurt. It's not, you know, we all know that words hurt, but the ideal is to teach kids, brush it off. If you want to respond to every insult, you're a fool, and you're destined for a life of misery. Just toughen up, brush it off, forget it. But what Manning and Campbell say has been happening, especially, and it happens first on campuses in the United States, is the transition to a victimhood culture. A culture of victimhood is one characterized by concern with status and sensitivity to slight, so just like an honor culture. Any little thing can cause it, you have to react. So people are intolerant of insults, even if unintentional, as in an honor culture. But here, they react differently. They don't deal with it themselves. They bring it to the attention of the authorities. If something happens, you don't deal with it yourself. You report it, you get the president of the university, the dean, somebody, some older person, some bureaucratic authority, you bring them in to punish the person who did this. In such a culture, you don't emphasize your strength. Rather, the aggrieved emphasize their oppression and their social marginalization. They also point out that the only way to gain status is not just to be a victim, but to stand up for other victims. And so even if you're not in a victim class, you can gain status by aggressively pursuing those who you think have marginalized members of the victim class. And the reason why this is so terrible for the students themselves is that once victimhood culture gets onto your campus, and once it gets into the teaching, students are literally taught to see people as members of good or bad groups. There's the good race and the bad race, the good gender and the bad gender, good, bad. Students are learning a Manichaean view of the world, good versus evil. This means that there is eternal conflict and grievance. There can never be peace in a victimhood culture. There is eternal conflict and grievance because that's what the struggle for status is all about. Students are walking on eggshells. In a victimhood culture, everyone is afraid. Everyone is self-censoring. And that's what leads them to implement or to demand safety culture. The whole idea, the very idea that a college campus is full of danger. These are unbelievably safe places. But the idea that words, ideas, and speakers could invalidate someone's existence is so threatening. We need protections. We need safe spaces. We need trigger warnings. The net effect is that the very people you're trying to help are rendered weaker, and they become moral dependents. They become morally dependent. So the reason why this is so bad for students is because of the other big psychological idea I want to share with you, which is anti-fragility. My first book, The Happiness Hypothesis, it was about 10 great truths, insights from around the world and across the millennia. Truth number 7 is that people are anti-fragile. So as Friedrich Nietzsche put it, what doesn't kill me makes me stronger. And there's a lot of research. It's not always true. There is PTSD. There are some things that can damage you. But for the most part, it's true. It's a great truth because it was noticed by many, many wise people in different cultures. Mengzi or Mencius said, "When heaven is about to confer a great responsibility on any man, it will exercise his mind with suffering, subject his sinews and bones to hard work, and place obstacles in the paths of his deeds so as to stimulate his mind, harden his nature, and improve wherever he is incompetent." You cannot be a great man or woman unless you have suffered, faced adversity, been banged around, failed, and come back, gotten back up 50, 100, 500 times. That's the only way to greatness. There's a wonderful book by Nassim Taleb called Anti-Fragile, and this is the key idea. And Taleb, I talked to him about this. He wishes he could find a better word, but there isn't one. So he made this word anti-fragile, but it's exactly right. And he describes anti-fragility as systems that increase in capability, resilience, or robustness as a result of mistakes, faults, attacks or failures. And he's very clear to say this is not resilience. If something is resilient, that means you can beat on it and it won't break, but it doesn't get stronger. No, he means things that actually get better. And so the examples that he gives that anyone can see, so bone is this way. Bone will toughen and harden to the extent that it's needed. And so if you take it easy on your bones, if you don't work them, if you're in weightlessness for months, they get weaker and weaker and weaker, and then when you experience weight, they'll break. The immune system is the same way. It is expecting experience. If you raise your kids and you use a lot of antibacterial wipes, you are crippling their immune system because the human immune system can't reach adulthood unless it experiences millions and billions of kinds of bacteria, hookworm, all sorts of parasites that it's expecting that it learns from. So the immune system will be crippled if you protect your kids. And of course, children. Children will be crippled if you protect them. So as we wrap our kids in bubble wrap, and this is what we began doing. So American parenting changed in the 1980s for a variety of historical reasons. In the 1980s, we began massively protecting our kids. Now, it's true there was a crime wave that began, so it wasn't imaginary. And it was amplified by the arrival in 1980 of cable TV. So we were afraid for our children, unnecessarily, it turns out. But we really sort of threw the blanket of protection over them beginning of the 1980s. And it wasn't just as infants. So helicopter parenting really takes off in the 1990s. Kids are raised for a variety of reasons. Parents are always there helping. Wait, here, you know, you need a Band-Aid. Did you remember this? So kids are not, they're not having unsupervised time. Unsupervised time used to be a feature of childhood. Every child spent a lot of time unsupervised every day. They'd work it out. They'd have fights in the playground. Some would call them stupid. They'd fight. But these are the experiences that make you grow up. And of course, now it goes all the way through college. I occasionally hear from business people tell me that when they turn someone down for a job, it has happened that their parents, the kids' parents, call them. So what do you think happened? How did it happen that when Hofstra University has the great honor to host the first debate, how on earth did it happen that Hofstra, rather than saying to its students, hooray, go sit in the front row, how did it happen that they came swooping in saying, now kids, you know, if you're upset, here's five numbers you can call. We're here to help. This is not helping because safety culture is debilitating. It is crippling. It is a terrible, terrible thing. Those who embrace it, those who embrace as an identity, my identity is that I am a victim, I am a member of a marginalized or oppressed group. I'm not denying that there's oppression. I'm saying if the more you foster that as your core identity, the weaker you get, the more angry you get, the less likely you are to thrive after leaving the bubble of safety. Who gets stronger from this? Straight white men. Straight white men are the only beneficiaries here because for 4 years they're told you're the bad guys, you're the evil ones, and there are no resources to support you in particular. What does that sound like? Frequent criticism and no special support. What does that sound like? A job, right? That's what a job is, okay? So straight white men have 4 years of preparation for a job, whereas anybody who grasps that identity has 4 years of dispreparation, or whatever you might say. And as I've been giving these talks, and I talk with people, and I meet business people at Stern, and they say, what is going on? I mean, I don't want to hire these kids. I mean, they're going to sue, they're going to cry. Like, what? I don't want these kids from this safety culture. So again, safety culture is debilitating. If you see signs of it here at Duke, run like hell.
Okay, that was his point of view. I'd like to hear yours if you'd like to call in. Please call in and share it. I'll save my comments until a little later. And that's professor of psychology, Jonathan Haidt, H-A-I-D-T. I'll just add a few points of view here. I knew a lot, virtually all of the leading holistic psychologists and physicians, Dr. Donald Mullen, Elaine Kahn, Carmi Harari. These are really good people. These were the high end of the field. And they all had something in common. They were very humanistic. But because they were friends of mine, and they were frequently having people who were having emotional problems, but they were not expert at their diet, and a person who's depressed would frequently be overweight, they would say, could you talk with this person, see about helping him in, you know, their diet? I said, sure. And what I found in every one of the people I was counseling for a period of time, that they felt as if they were victims, and therefore they didn't see themselves as being a contributor to their depression or to their disease states. And they were always looking back at the type of childhood they had. That's where most of the psychotherapy and psychoanalysis occurred. And my goal was not simply to have them lose some weight or take some nutrients, but rather ask them a basic question. Who are you? If you were to describe who you are, what would it be? Who would you be? If you got up in front of a room and said, I'm not going to tell you what I do because my career is only one facet of who I am. I'm not going to tell you about my family or my relationship or my friendships, important as they are, and they are, that's just but one part of who I am. Here's my core value. And when I would speak with these people, what I saw then was that the dynamic of their lack of confidence, their fear of failing, their fear of being criticized, or they had been criticized, their sense of low self-esteem, even if it wasn't obvious, and they were frequently functional, meaning they'd go to work, and no one knew the pain that they were suffering, because he generally hid it. But once we got to where they were able to identify their authentic self and honor that, that became the dominant energy. And since no two energies can ever share the same space at the same time with equal intensity, the dominant energy in many people today, especially young people, is I'm a victim. You know, you said something I don't like, therefore you invalidated my life, and I immediately must tell someone, and the group will come and pounce on you and beat you to death because you deserve it, because you invalidated me by saying something. I mean, this is the strangeness that we're experiencing today. And so the dominant energy collapses all other energies. You can only have one reality at a time. But your intuition and your true spiritual nature, these are not allowed to manifest the choices that would keep you happy and healthy and filled with love and joy and trust and openness. Instead, you become rigidified into this cocoon of defensive posturing. Now go to a school where other people say, we're all victims of old white-haired white men. And suddenly, it doesn't matter that that old white-haired white man might be Walt Whitman. They wouldn't even know who Walt Whitman is. And I can assure you they've never read Leaves of Grass nor anything else that has a literary meaning to it. That man might have been Robert Frost, the most famous poet in American history. They wouldn't care. Or it could be any one of many people who are decent, loving, kind, thoughtful people. This is the danger of identity politics. And it's being not just spread like a massive viral infection, but the administrators and the heads of colleges and many of the faculty also are encouraging this to give it some legitimacy. So remember, in that protective environment where they have more freedom, where no one limits you. When you're on a college campus, you can take any course you want, any degree you want. Just remember, when you come out of there, you're going to face the real world. And for those of us whose moms let us go out and come back and have our lunch and then go out again and come back before dinner, we had the freedom to express, to explore, to find, to interrelate, and we grew from it. It was a hot summer day and we were out playing. We all went over to a water hose and drank out of it. You know, we all survived. This idea that we must micromanage every single thought within a child, that doesn't look good on you. Say this, not that. You need this, not that. At some point, the child begins to lose a sense of who they are, and they simply start to mirror it. The insecurities of the mother and father, one or both, and therefore afraid of disappointing them. And so love comes episodically and highly conditionally based upon you won, isn't that great, or here's your, you got an award, aren't you special? No, we shouldn't be loving our children because what they achieve or how they mimic our own insecurities. We should love a child because we're filled with love and they're our child. We're just seeing this, and it's at an epidemic level, and this is the danger of identity politics, and the left is extremely, extremely culpable. If you think this is how you're going to make a better nation, well, think you gave us Hillary Clinton, and here's a question for you. Why has no one on the liberal corporate community held her accountable for the genocide in Yemen? She's the one who originally supported Saudi Arabia having the largest arms deal in its history. They actually celebrated the State Department on, I believe it was New Year's or Christmas Eve, this huge deal. They knew what they were going to do with those arms. They were going to arm terrorist groups, which they did. And now look at Saudi Arabia having no criticism, and they're in Yemen, where right now that's the world's worst genocide occurring. 19 million citizens of Yemen are dying or will suffer tremendously. And I just posted a child who weighed, I think the child weighed 9 pounds, should have weighed 50 pounds. And you look at this little, just skin and bones, we're responsible. Donald Trump is responsible. The trouble is he's too stupid to realize how dumb he is. He is functionally illiterate, but the people around him are not. The neocons, the Boltons, these are the people who control everything. Now, just imagine being one of their kids. What virtues are you going to learn? Imagine all the professionals, the doctors, the lawyers, the professors, and the engineers who don't have time for their children, but make sure they have a nanny and get in the best schools and have teaching and coaches, make sure they pass all their grades and get ahead. No time for that kid to ever be a kid, and they fear failing. So guilt and shame are the front and back ends of their life. What do you think they're going to do when they're finally free of the emotional sepsis of the parents' control? They're going to hate you. And if you doubt me that they hate you, then sit in my office when that boil is lanced and they say what they really feel. Whoa. And we're living in denial of this. So why isn't Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama held accountable for the genocide in Libya? Why isn't Amy Goodman held accountable for supporting regime change in Syria? Right now, the largest open-air slave market in the world is in Libya. Is there an irony to this at all? A man who gets the Nobel Prize for Peace and causes a country to collapse, tens of millions to go into suffering, death, and displacement? Is there no Me Too movement for the poor of the world, for the women of Saudi Arabia? We just live in such hypocrisy. Jeff from New Jersey. Jeff, it's your turn. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing today, Gary?
Thank you.
So,
all right.
All right, good. I would say humorously that the problem on campus goes back to the big purple dinosaur. As I watched in the 80s, 90s, that Sesame Street was replaced by things like Barney and other children programs that did not deal with the day-to-day relationships. Sesame Street was really unique in itself that it talked to the children as if they were individuals, as if they were, you know, human beings. When you look at the other programs now that came after it, they talk to the children as if they were cartoons, that everything was this. And, you know, if it rained that day, that controlled your emotions. You were sad because it rained. When the sun came out, so it took away the ability, you know, whereas on Sesame Street, if it did rain, you went out and you played in the rain. You know, you enjoyed the puddles. It was explained to you how rain helps plants grow. With these other programs, like I said, you became a victim. You were controlled by outside forces. So I think this is some of what we're seeing on campus now, that this whole thing has unfolded and come up where you have people who cannot deal with relationships and disagreements and come to terms, because everything at the end of these programs were wrapped in a nice, neat bow. And it was beautiful. You know, everything was complete. It was finished. It was, everybody left the program happy. Whereas Sesame Street, you may not be happy, but you came to a resolution. You came to a compromise. You dealt with characters, even on Mr. Rogers, you dealt with characters that were ornery. You dealt with characters that were pompous, you know, but you learned to deal with them in their own way, and that they showed, not only were they just pompous, but they also had a heart on the other side, that they cared for their people. So what we're seeing now is, and I think another part of it is that with the internet, a lot of history, a lot of the wrongdoings in the world are becoming evident. You can't hide from the truth. Kids in college nowadays sometimes are are from privileged families. And they're beginning to understand the industry. You know, if you're a daughter or a son of someone who's in the pharmaceutical industry, how do you face that you made your money in this way? So I think some of the victimization is just throwing off the guilt, you know, that the guilt has come on to the, from they realize how they have their privilege And in order to kind of deflect the privilege or the responsibility of the privilege, and I think one of the things this gentleman mentioned in there was, you know, in order to become a great man, great woman, you have to go through this hard work. But they're not willing to go through the hard work because, again, go back to Barney. Everything was wrapped in a nice, complete package. There was no conflict resolution. There was no opposition to your opinion. Everyone moved as one in a group. So they either don't know about the hard work, or they don't want to do the hard work that will make them correct the things, you know, and also maybe give up part of their privilege to correct what their wealth and their privilege has taken away or done to other people. You know, so that's my thing. And the thing with, you know, we're talking about, and again, these things with Yemen, we're watching around the world and we know these things. It's kind of in the back of the mind. It's not necessarily out front, but it's in the back of the mind because everyone's heard of it. They may not pay attention to it. And again, here's the guilt. This is American money going in to bomb these cities or bomb these countries. This is American money causing the suffering. This is who we have elected officials on both sides of the aisle. And I will argue that there's no such thing as a liberal in politics anymore, and that the Democrats are now the old Republicans, and the old Republicans are now the Tea Party. But that they're watching at these people that they supported. I mean, and so many people fought tooth and nail to have Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee, knowing that Bernie Sanders was a 10-point favorite above both her and Donald Trump. But they fought because they believed that this a woman should have an opportunity to do this. And then to turn around, now they have to face the facts that the person that they supported is doing this to other people and enjoys doing what she's doing to other people in other countries. So we have a bunch of people in I believe in denial, and a bunch of people who are faced with things that they are not prepared to face. So they change themselves into victims. They change themselves to say, "Well, listen, it's again." Someone says it's the victim Olympics. I don't necessarily agree with that term, but it just seems as though folks will cry. I don't know how to explain it, but they will yell louder. The loudest wheel gets the oil. So they're looking to get pacified rather than, like you said, do the work to change the world, do the work to sacrifice their privilege to help other people that they, you know, they built their wealth and their privilege on.
You've made several very important points, Jeff, and I appreciate that. Let me add a few to the thought process here. The purpose of university should be to develop critical thinking skills, not what to be memorized as propaganda as an absolute truth with no ability to challenge it. We need challenge. We need open debate. We need to have forums where people can come together and we can see who has the more reasonable argument, who is more rigidified, who is just there spewing talking points. And we don't have that today. There are individuals who could come up and debate on any issue. They're protested. It's as if you will say, if you're a student, this person coming on this campus violates the sanctity of my being, and I don't want that because I feel bad. And then the university will have 15 people come around that person. They're called defensive friends. And these people are paid to coddle, to cradle, in effect to emotionally pacify someone who can't handle the fact that someone may have a different opinion. And what's particularly interesting is some of the smartest women who are out there happen to hold some conservative views. They're not, you know, the rank and file Republican, but some of their views, they're not afraid of challenging some of the tenets of second wave or third wave feminism. And one of them I play her at work because she's so smart in what she says. So she has such a prescient way of sharing insights is Camille Paglia. I defy you to see a debate where she's debating anyone and doesn't come out sounding the most reasonable, because she's brutally honest about everything. She won't compromise. And what you have today is you have most of the people on college campuses by consensus compromising. And when you compromise, it is a non-virtuous compromise. It is an extraordinarily dysfunctional compromise. So as a result, children are coming out and going into college and coming out as young adults where they do not know what they value or why, except they know how they feel. So everything's about, what do I feel, and are you there to support me in my feelings? What if your feelings are pathological at a social or humanistic level? You're not going to care about giving up meat. You're not going to make any changes in your life because it could save the planet. Because nothing in the 112 million, there are exceptions, but the 112 million professional class members and the millionaire members, there's 17.2 million and 10 million. When you add in the four per family, you're 112 million. One-third of the American population are not going to do a damn thing for anyone except themselves. And for this generation, they've been raised not to care about anything except the politics of identity politics. They do not care about whether there was suffering in eating an animal in a hamburger. They don't care about stop consuming. They're going to consume more because that makes them feel good. And if you dare suggest anything they're consuming they don't need and shouldn't do, suddenly you are depreciating the value of my life. And therefore, they value almost everything that is a negative virtue. There is no sense of the aesthetic. They will not reduce their spending consumption. And as a result, they become what they think. And what they think is, the only thing that's important in my life is what my mom and dad said, that I'm perfect, I'm here, I'm special, and you better not say a thing, not even think a thing. I don't even want to see your hairstyle make me feel threatened. And yet there is no threat. There's more freedom. There's more opportunity today in America on college campuses than ever before in history. And yet they deny all this because they have become so self-righteous in the idea of my story is valid. Anything you say to the contrary to force me to rewrite or rethink my story invalidates my being. And then you have the Moorish goons of academia, the managers, the presidents. These are supercilious idiots coming forth to say, yo, we're going to protect this person. Yeah, I'll bet you are. And America suffers as a consequence. Thank you very much, Jeff, for calling in. You made a lot of very valid points. I appreciate it. For all of you listening, thank you. Tomorrow we'll continue, and every day I'm going to bring something else that hopefully stimulates our thought at a deeper level, more than just what we feel, but what we think. Have a nice day, everyone.
Hello, baby. How've you been? You sure look good. You know, it's been a long time since we've been together. You know, I would like very much if we could tighten things up and kind of get back together again. But I'd like to ask you just one question.